Blog Talk Radio.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Welcome to Stovetop Politics, the episode that's been a long time coming. I'm your host, Virginia Crudo. With me is my producer, Stephen Hamilton. And we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff over the next hour. We can kind of get off with the start with the I'm trying to think where am I going with this, Hammy? I'm having an issue apparently. So Netanyahu came to speak before Congress and gave a speech that really makes the president look, not that that's difficult to do, but you know, I was looking at the speech and my response to the entire thing was basically he tells the truth. He tells the unvarnished truth. And he quotes Robert Frost. Can we just have him back? I mean, he grew up in the States. He was educated here. Can we just have him here? I mean, I'm kind of having because I've listened to Netanyahu this last week. And I went back and I listened to the foreign policy heavy speech given by Rick Perry at CPAC this year, which we're going to play part of that later on in the show. And I'm really, really tired of having a president with no foreign policy. And I don't mean with bad foreign policy, with no foreign policy. The current president, that you have to be able to relate with other countries. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be able to have dinner with their leaders. Doesn't mean you have to be able to play golf with their officials. It means that you have to be able to relate with foreign countries. And you can't do that if you can't articulate your own stance. Or if you can't take a stand, you know, So it's very hard for me to watch this, especially when we see such great examples of people who understand foreign policy. I mean, I'm looking at Rick Perry, who, you know, 50% of Texas's border with someone other than, you know, the Gulf of Mexico. 50% of Texas's land border is with a foreign country. This is a guy, and it's not necessarily a friendly foreign country. This is a foreign country who sent their president to Congress to chastise them on our immigration policy. And a lot of the people in Congress who invited him to do that are now yelling at John Boehner and the other Republicans for inviting Netanyahu to simply ask the president to consider the position of U.S.-Israeli relations before he inks a stupid deal with Iran. It doesn't seem like that'd be too much to ask, but apparently it is. Hammy, did you hear Netanyahu's speech?
Yeah, I certainly did. And to kind of follow up on what you're saying, I mean, any treaty or anything that he would make, he'd have to clear through Congress eventually, at least through the Senate. So why not have the Senate be able to, you know, speak with the groups that are going to be impacted by that?
Well, as long as he doesn't call it a treaty, then he can do whatever he wants. Haven't you been watching the news?
Yeah, well, within reason.
Well, you say within reason, but here's the thing. We're getting to see how this works firsthand, and in some ways it's good, and in some ways it's very, very dangerous. With the president that we have, it's more on the dangerous side. But you know the way presidential politics work. The Constitution gives him very limited powers, and technically, unless it says in the Constitution that he can't do it, he can do it until one of the other branches checks him. And so when he goes out there and says, well, I'm going to make this agreement and I'm not going to call it a treaty, I dare you to stop me. I mean, it's basically what he's doing. In order for us to fight this, they've got to be willing to stop
it. That's true of almost everything he does.
That's the problem that we've had. That's the problem we have. We've had, and I wish I had the audio of it for you. There was a very far left college professor who, and you could probably look it up on YouTube. He gave a speech talking about the dangers of Congress ceding their responsibility to the president. Not because he absolutely agrees with what Obama's doing with all of these, with the results of what he's doing. But he was saying, but here's the thing. If Congress sits by and allows him to just do it unilaterally, they cede their power and the republic ceases to work. So what happens when there's a far right president who's going to do this? Congress, now there is now precedent that he can do it without Congress stopping him. So he's concerned for the future of the republic, even though the president is doing things he agrees with. He does not like the way in which he's doing it, and that's kind of, I mean, that's why we fight the narrative where Obama's making executive orders and he's doing, you know, he's vetoing things that he shouldn't, and, you know, he's bypassing Congress. Well, what if it was a Republican who was doing these things? Would you still be angry? Well, yes, because this isn't how it's supposed to work. You know, we're not talking about the ends justify the means only works for a certain amount of time, and then the republic's lost because you've compromised it. So
it's one of the things I've been saying for a while to people is, you know, we're screaming and yelling about treason and going outside the Constitution and, you know, bypassing Congress and all these other things. But if you look at the majority of the things that he's doing with the stroke of his pen, he's simply exercising the power that's been granted to him by Congress through basically them abdicating their own authority.
Right. And that's the thing. No other branch has a problem with exercising their own authority and even usurping it when they don't get enough. When you look at the way the Supreme Court has reacted in certain cases, even as far back as Marbury versus Madison, I mean, that was a power grab if you've ever seen one. So for that to not be, you know, for Congress to not only not take extra power in some cases like this, but to actively give up the power they have. It seems odd because, you know, obviously the president is willing to take anything that he wants. And it's confusing to me that they would be willing to give up so easily when – I mean, they obviously want to control our lives. What's it seems odd that they wouldn't want to take power back. I mean,
well, most of
it's
for implementation.
Before, it's rare.
Yeah, most of it happens through implementation. They pass bills that have to be carried out by some group, some organization, and the majority of those groups, as they've been built up over time, these departments or whatever, have been put under the executive branch. So they give the power to execute these bills to the executive branch, which gives the executive branch a ton of leniency and leeway in how they actually implement them. Almost always, if you look at those bills, it's that way.
Well, to an extent, yes. I mean, but I mean, it is the executive branch. It's in the job description that they're supposed to implement. I mean, they're supposed to enforce the laws passed by Congress. I mean, George Washington referred to himself as the chief magistrate. That's their job. So that's not straight. But, you know, you see stuff like every once in a while you'll see something where the president tries to take power and Congress will say, oh, no, you don't. The most glaring example of this would be the War Powers Act. I don't know if this was under Nixon when Congress said, oh, wait a second, you can't wage war without us. That's our job. And they said essentially that was when it became law that the president can only wage war without congressional approval for 60 days, and he can only take, you know, strategic military action without telling Congress for 48 hours, or is it 48 or 72? I can't remember. But like, for example, the raid on Osama bin Laden, the president did not have to tell Congress that he was doing that. He has 48 hours or 72 hours to inform Congress that he's taken that action. He can make the call and send military in for a decisive strike like that without ever informing Congress, until after the fact. And part of that is because the more people you tell, the more likely it is to leak. It makes sense for the president to have that kind of strategic leeway, especially on something that big, that important, that had to be carried out in such a precise manner. It's good that fewer people can have that information. But what happened when they passed this was Nixon didn't like it, and he vetoed it. And that was one of the few successful veto overrides in American history, because Congress turned around and said, no, no, you are not taking this power from us. It's ours. And constitutionally it is. So they were absolutely right to do it. But there are other times when Congress should have done that and didn't. And they've fallen down on the job in a lot of places as far as that's concerned. So I'm going to really quick comment on what's going on in the chat room. This a website associated with Anonymous trying to advance a narrative that the Obama kids are not their own. This is something that actually Chuck C. Johnson has posted this too, which you know, it kind of amused me because he was posting all these tweets a couple weeks ago talking about all of this explosive information that he had. Of course, he never actually posted the information. He just posted that, well, hey, I have this information, and if I post it, I'll get death threats. I'm like, okay, prove it. But, you know, pretty much par for the course with him. But he went ahead and was talking about how there are no pictures of Michelle Obama pregnant. You know what? I bet those kids aren't even hers. You know what? I've had 5 kids. Want to know how many pictures there are of me pregnant? You want to guess?
5.
Now I did with Misfit Baby. I did do a maternity session, so there are pictures from that one. But before that, the 4 kids previous, there are maybe 2 pictures in existence of me pregnant, and I might be showing in one of them. So the fact that they don't exist doesn't mean that they're not her kids. Because, you know, I'll just say this. I was there when my kids were born, so whether or not the pictures are there, trust me, they're my kids. Although occasionally, you know, I'll have one that, you know, doesn't like chocolate, and then I have to wonder. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. So we're going to talk a little bit about Scott Walker tonight. I'm going to just change the subject on the fly. I'm sure that you've all seen the articles over the last week or so complaining about how Scott Walker hired pretty people. Yeah, he has a couple of aides who are not ugly, and this is news. And I think that's the problem right there, that it's news that Scott Walker hired somebody who wasn't ugly. I mean, really? First of all, and Hammy, you and I were talking about this before, the aides are supposed to represent Scott Walker to the people who talk to his office and don't get to see him. Their job is to sell Scott Walker. Do you hire ugly people to sell anything? Really? I mean, if the point is to make them the face of your brand when you're not there, you don't hire somebody that's not going to reflect that. You don't hire somebody who's not going to. Now, it's going to help if they're smart too, or if they can, you know, string a sentence together without sounding like an idiot. Okay, great. But you're going to not hire them because that doesn't even make any sense. It doesn't pass the sniff test. It just really doesn't. And what bothers me about this is not just that, but, I mean, there are so many other things to get worked up about, you know, whether or not the people that Scott Walker hires is, it's stupid. But the other problem with it is that now we have people on both sides of the aisle giving this story validation by saying stuff like, well, you know, here I am, I'm working in media, and I'm not 25, and I'm not a size 2, and, you know, I have to work twice as hard for people to take me seriously. And I'll be honest, some of you have seen me in person. I'm not a big person. I'm maybe 5'6", and maybe 125. Are you telling me that I didn't work my butt off to get where I am? Is that what you're saying? That you know, now all of a sudden what you're doing is you're minimizing the effort of anybody who does look like Scott Walker's aides. So, I mean, have it one way, or you can't have it both ways is all that I'm trying to get at. Would you agree with that, Stephen?
You know what floors me? Any of these people have worked for any other organization at all? I don't care if it's media. I mean, have you ever worked in pharma, or known people that work in pharma? They go out and they hire really pretty people. Okay, I mean, that's you go down to the class of new salespeople coming in. That gets them in the door because it's, let's be honest, eye candy. Gets them in the door, presents well, looks good, can get to that doctor. Then they have to sell.
Right.
They don't sell, I don't care how pretty they are. But that is a standard marketing thing. What are you going to do? That's life. That's who we are. We're human beings.
Right. Now, I don't know. I mean... I started out with my own personal blog, and I do, you know, I've done a radio show just about every week for a little over a year now. I don't have to look a certain way to do any of that. And when I write something, I don't expect people to look at my profile picture before they decide whether or not to share it, because I don't usually post my picture with it. I just post the article that I wrote. You know, so when people share it, they share it because they like what I wrote, not because I look a certain way. Or, you know, so for anybody to say, and that's the thing, a lot of the people I know who are making these complaints have started the same way, with personal blogs, with blog talk radio shows, with other web-based radio or other online media that doesn't require you to be visible. And so what they're saying is a whole bunch of people who didn't have the opportunity to see me and can't see what I look like are prejudiced against me because of the way I look. I'm sorry, what? Doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, does that make any sense to you? How do you...
No.
How do I math, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll quote Dana, 2 + 2 = dolphin. No. So, yeah, the whole thing frustrated me. And you know, thanks, Craig, for posting this. It's an attempt to neuter Scott Walker's message by trying to make it seem like his message won't sell unless sex comes with it. I get that to a point, but why are they not complaining about, you know, Marie Harf? I'm not saying that she's beautiful, but she's not, I mean, she's not necessarily ugly, right? I mean, she does have kind of that David Spade look to her, but, you know, that meme's been done a few times. And did you see, have you seen that? It's pretty funny.
Yep.
So yeah, that's been kind of fun. So I don't know. I do want to talk a little bit about CPAC and kind of the, yeah, there were a lot of people angry, about the Jeb Bush walkout. I don't know. Did you get that vibe at all? That
well, I didn't get the Jeb Bush walkout to begin with.
What?
There were a few. I didn't get the Jeb Bush walkout to begin with. There were a few protesters in the hallway, 20 somethings acting like 12 somethings. But beyond that,
see,
there was a pretty full hall.
Yeah. No, there were a few people who got up and walked out on the Jeb Bush speech. And I'm like, there were some people that were upset about that. And I'm like, I get being upset if they're acting like idiots, either disrupting the speech or, you know, in the hallway or whatever. And I know they had, some of them were actually told that they had to leave or have security called. But excuse me, apparently I'm dying here.
Yeah,
but there were
the
some
show.
People who got up and walked out. Yeah, live radio. Yay. There were some people who got up and walked out, and there were other people who were upset about this. Like, that's disrespectful and blah, blah, blah. That's what you're supposed to do. That's how you voice your opinion. If you are at CPAC, and they bring in the last guy you want representing the Republican Party writ large, you vote with your feet. You stand up and you leave. That's how you express your opinion. That's how civilized people express their opinion. You don't sit in the hall and boo. You don't, like, you know, there's no point in disrupting the speech. You just get up and leave. And so that, you know, to me, that was exactly what they should have done. As far as just leaving and not making a big deal out of it. But there were people that were, being childish about it. And then, of course, there were all the people who were talking about how the Rand Paul supporters stacked the straw poll. And I don't know if they did. I don't really care if they did.
Well, they do every year.
But here's my thinking. Look at who actually votes in the straw poll.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing every year. Rand Paul wins. It's every year. It's the same thing. And it's just as meaningless.
No, in 2012, Mitt Romney won the straw poll. I mean, that was...
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I think so.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Ron Paul didn't win. I mean, that was for sure Ron Paul didn't win.
I know Ron Paul won it in... Well, the last time I was there, which was 13.
2013,
and, yeah, and then I wasn't there last year. I think Rand won it last year.
Yeah, he did. So I think the whole CPAC, I mean, for me, it's more about networking than actually listening to the speeches anyway. I know that's horrible. Most of them I end up listening to later as opposed to when they're actually going on. If I go and sit in the main hall, it's because there's a panel that I want to hear, and But I do think it's interesting that they keep trying to do youth outreach panels. And then they bring in a bunch of older people to do them. which just really, it amuses me every time. And it's the same thing, like Stacey Washington and Keira Davis, they've talked about how much they hate doing, like, the minority outreach panels. Like, you know what? If you can't sell freedom and liberty, you suck. It's just, there's one message. It's, you know, constitutional limited government. It's beneficial for everybody, and here's why. You don't have to break it down by demographic to say, and this is why women should be conservative. And this is, you know, there's no reason to do that. Because when you do, you're basically telling them that, A, you're not smart enough if I just give you the message. I have to tailor it to you because you're an idiot. And that just... It doesn't make any sense. And yet we keep doing it. This is one of the Republican Party's main problems. The other one is our inability to stop talking. And it's a disease that's best exemplified by Ron Paul. How many times has he said something that's absolutely brilliant? And
are you asking
kept
me?
Going just long enough.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, no, not necessarily. It just so what I guess what I'm saying. Every once in a while, Ron Paul will say something that's completely brilliant, usually involving domestic fiscal policy, because let's face it, he knows that stuff. But then he keeps talking just long enough to remind everybody that he's, you know, completely insane. And so that's been our problem for a long time. It was Todd Akin's problem. It was Richard Murdoch's problem in Indiana. It cost them Senate seats. But it's this whole, you know, well, how do you feel? What's your position on abortion? Well, I'm pro-life. Well, what about in the case of rape or incest? The answer should have been, I'm pro-life, 100%, no exceptions, next question. But then they start trying to answer the question. And that's where we lose. We lose because what is it they tell you if you ever go to court? You only answer the question they ask you. You never give them more information than they're asking for. Republicans can't do that. We have a pathological inability to stop talking and let well enough alone. And it's killing the party. I think that's where we have the biggest problem, is a bunch of Republican candidates who don't know when to shut up. So I think that's a good time to take a break. You want to go ahead and run your spot, and then we can pick up with Rick Perry's speech from CPAC.
You're listening to the alternative source of news, talk, and music for today's unconventional conservatives. This is AltCon Radio.
Okay, we are back. This is Stovetop Politics. I am your host, Virginia Gruda, and we are going to be talking about this in just a minute. But we're going to go ahead and play for you a part of Rick Perry's speech from CPAC, mostly where it regards foreign policy. It's about 7 minutes, so bear with me on this. But He has impressed me over the years. I realize he had some less than impressive debate performances a couple of years ago, but I definitely think he's going to be one to watch. And this speech kind of gives you an idea why. So go ahead and run it, Hammy.
I come here today to speak plainly about the times that we live in. At no time in the last 25 years has the future been more uncertain and the world more dangerous than it is today. On 3 points, we must be clear. First, our country has entered a time of testing, and our political leadership is failing the test. The American people see a president who bows to political correctness, in denial of the threats that we face, making grave miscalculations that make the world less safe. Now, this administration's incompetence in Iraq and Syria have allowed the emergence of ISIS. They're in American tanks, they're using American weapons, and ISIS began taking cities that just a few years ago were secured by American blood. Now, let's be very, very clear about who ISIS is, what they represent. They are a religious movement that seeks to take the world back to the 7th century. Their aims are apocalyptic. They mean to cleanse the world, not just of Christians and Jews, but of Muslims who disagree with their extreme ideology. And it is their stated vow to kill as many Americans as possible. It's time. It is time for the American people to hear the truth. The president declared in the State of the Union that the advance of ISIS has been stopped, and that is simply not true. He says that ISIS is a religious movement. Again, he's simply wrong. To deny the fundamental religious nature of the threat and to downplay the seriousness of it is naive, it is dangerous, and it is misguided. ISIS represents the worst threat to freedom since communism. If Egypt and Jordan recognize that they are at war with radical Islam, isn't it about time our president proclaimed the same? We didn't start this war, nor did we choose it, but we will have the will to finish it. Now, let me state another obvious fact about the Middle East. It is not in the interest of peace and security of the free world that Iran be allowed to develop nuclear weapons. Reports concerning this bilateral negotiation between the United States and Iran indicate a deal on the table would allow Iran to develop nuclear power after a certain number of years if they live up to certain treaty obligations. I believe it is fundamentally dangerous to grant Iran's nuclear ambitions diplomatic cover. Our discussions with Iran should be governed by two non-negotiable principles. Number one is, Iran should not be allowed to develop nuclear weapons, period. And number two, Israel has the right to exist as a Jewish state. Yeah, amen. It's time. It's time we stood with the most vibrant democracy in the Middle East. The administration's policy of isolating Israel must stop. You know, watching all of this unfold, is the president of Russia. He's been watching as our president drew a line, a red line in Syria that was crossed without consequence. And then this Russian president watched as our president canceled plans to deploy missile systems in Poland and the Czech Republic. And it was against this backdrop of weakness and empty words that Putin annexed Crimea. He entered Ukraine. And it was those conditions that allowed him to negotiate a one-sided ceasefire at Minsk with no real consequences. Here's the simple truth about our foreign policy. Our allies doubt us, and our adversaries are all too willing to test us. No one should be surprised. No one should be surprised that dictators like Assad would cross the president's red line because he knows the president won't even defend the line that separates our nation from Mexico. There aren't any real consequences. There are no real consequences when dictators and adversaries defy America, and this must change. For the world to be safer, America must be stronger. And for America to be safer, our border must be secure. Drug cartels, transnational gangs, they smuggle drugs and weapons and people. They are a clear and present danger to the health and the safety of all Americans. Any conversation about comprehensive immigration reform must begin with comprehensive border security. And that's exactly why. That's exactly why last summer I told the president, looked him right in the eye, and I said, if you will not secure the border between Texas and Mexico, Texas will.
Okay. So that was, as I said, that was an excerpt from Rick Perry's speech at CPAC about a week and a half ago. And been impressed on more than one occasion by his assessment of where we stand as a country, specifically when as it regards foreign policy. But if you go ahead and look up the rest of the speech, it's on YouTube. It's about 20 minutes long altogether, so it's not too much of an investment. But he goes on to talk about the unemployment rate and the effect on the middle class that our current jobs policies have had, and he really does know what he's talking about, despite poor appearances in the 2012 election. And what I think is interesting, if you look at what happened in 2012. He put out a couple of ads kind of at the beginning of the presidential campaign, and the media went after him very quickly, and they capitalized on the fact that he did poorly in a debate. And, you know, he admitted himself that he wasn't prepared for it. I'd be interested to see kind of how this goes. But I was thinking, remember a few weeks ago, there was all that talk about the measles outbreaks, and then the president said, just kind of off the cuff, you know, he hadn't really considered whether or not a vaccine mandate would be a good idea. And then, of course, the entire internet exploded because, well, you know, vaccines, we should mandate them. No, we shouldn't mandate them. And you know, some of the people who are for mandates are Republican, and some people who are for mandates are Democrats. And it was kind of basically dividing everybody. But particularly the goal was to divide conservatives, because you have people who are anti-vaccine altogether. And then there are people who are pro-vaccine but anti-mandate, and then which is kind of where I fall. But then, and we've talked about that before. But then you also have conservatives who either out of fear or what have you, that'll say, okay, well, in this case, a mandate's justifiable. Go ahead and do that. And here's what I'm wondering. When it comes down to it, what is the one thing that the media can use against Rick Perry? I mean, they really can't use his record in Texas against him because there are a lot of jobs in Texas right now. Texas is in the black. Most states in the union are in the red. So they really can't use that against him. They can't say he has no foreign policy chops because we've heard it. He's been dealing with, 50% of his land border is with a foreign country. He's got more foreign policy chops than the president does at this point. So, and he's got, governing experience. There's not a whole lot they can use against him. There is one thing they can use against him. He is the only person, as of right now, who looks to be running for the 2016 nomination who has implemented a vaccine mandate, and there are a lot of people pissed off about that. So if you freak people out, make them think, hey, vaccine mandate could be on the horizon, get enough people angry about that. And then you can say, well, you know what? If you're worried about vaccine mandates, here's a guy who's actually done. He's actually done it. Don't vote for him. What do you think, Hammy? That sound about? Am I too conspiratorial on this one, or does that sound like something that they'd go with? I don't know.
No, I think it's fair. I don't think you're too conspiratorial. Not this time. You think Ron Paul makes some really great points at times, so I'm questioning that part. But other than that.
I do think that, auditing the Fed might be a good idea, but no.
Just giving you a hard time.
I'm just saying, in terms of general domestic fiscal policy, Ron Paul makes some good points, and I feel the same way about his son. Their foreign policy terrifies the crap out of me. I mean, to buy into the libertarian foreign policy, this whole non-intervention thing at this point, you literally have to be the kid who is willing to stand in the middle of the playground with his eyes closed and depend on the notion that there's nobody mean enough to tie your shoes together just to watch you fall on your face when you try to walk away. Well, we have company. It's going to get loud, guys.
I have met Misfit Baby, by the way.
He sounds like a puppy, but it's... Yeah, so it sounds like a puppy, but it's not. I promise. I don't know. The Ron Paul foreign policy is a little bit creepy. And I really am... I like the almost Reagan-esque foreign policy that I'm hearing from Rick Perry. And I know he's not the only one talking that way. There are a lot of guys who are posturing. Scott Walker, for one, has kind of put forth a similar idea that America's got to be, for the world to be safer, America has to be stronger. That's Reagan foreign policy. Peace through strength. And I think it was right, and I think we were wrong to get away from it. So,
We did what we always do. This country, sorry to totally break in here, but from a military standpoint, it's so annoying to me.
No, go ahead.
We run on ebbs and tides. And so at the end, what happened right after Reagan was everybody turned around and said, we did this huge buildup, 800 ship Navy and all this stuff and all that to defeat the Soviet Union, and stupidly stood back and went, well, the Soviet Union's not there anymore, so we got nobody else to care about. And people will jump in immediately on that, because when they want to reduce military spending, they'll jump in immediately and take whatever they can to help do it. So it always leaves us in a lurch later on that we're unable to meet the requirements of the military that we have.
Right. Well, let's look at it. I use the baseball analogy sometimes too. I mean, what is the winningest team in baseball?
Yankees.
You know? Yeah. What is the most hated team in baseball?
Boston Red Sox.
Only if you're a Yankees fan. Generally speaking, the most hated team in baseball is the Yankees. Why? Because they beat everybody else. How many people do you know who would love every time the Yankees are in the World Series? They want to see them lose just because somebody's sticking it to New York. If you look at the United States, I mean, look at where we are as far as, you know, geopolitical positioning. We've been on top for so long that there are people who hate us just for that. And they like to see the people on top getting taken down a peg. Now, there are some people that are like, okay, you know, well, we're against everything the United States stands for. We want you guys all to die in fire, et cetera, et cetera. You see ISIS, and that's what they're doing. But there are other countries in, you know, Eastern Europe, in Asia, who really, they don't necessarily care if all Americans die, but they'd be okay with somebody taking us down a notch. You know, that's because, you know what, if they take away some of America's power, that's more for us. You know, we could get a piece of that. That's kind of how I see it. And the problem is that Ron Paul's foreign policy, it's like communism. It works in theory until you enter human nature. Socialism works until you realize that human beings are ambitious and greedy, and you can't legislate them out of that. Or you can't legislate that out of them. You can't take away. I mean, you can legislate innovation out of them, but you can't make them not ambitious, and you can't make them not want to be individuals. So on paper, socialism works, but when you implement it, people are actually people, and that causes a problem. The same thing stands for this foreign policy, you know. Well, yeah, if you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone, except for people don't actually operate that way. There are people who want more power, and there are people who want more land, and there are people who just want to kill other people. So you can't have a foreign policy that doesn't address that. And that's where my problem lies with the Ron Paul foreign policy, is that it doesn't begin to address that. In fact, it assumes that it doesn't exist. At best, it's naive, and at worst, it's willfully ignorant. Because you can't have been alive in the last 20 years and not realize that human beings are human beings, and this isn't going to work. So, I don't know.
The immediate failure is the assumption that the only thing that affects us is something that might attack us on our own shores, and just completely ignoring the fact that we live in a global economy. We have a vested interest in protecting the seaways and protecting commerce, and I'm not even thinking straight, with other countries and such.
Right.
And keeping stable powers in the world actually helps us.
And that's why I love it when people quote Thomas Jefferson, talk about how we should have, you know, free trade, but no entangling alliances. Well, yeah, he believed that. And then he thought better of it when he realized that the only way to deal with the Barbary pirates was to get involved in, you know, he entered the United States into its first war on foreign soil because he realized firsthand that this foreign policy does not work in application.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we ended. I mean, that's why the Marine hymn begins the way it does. So, I mean, we were on the shores of Tripoli because we had to. to protect, to protect our interests, to protect our trade routes. And to not recognize that, again, willful ignorance at its best. So anyway, so we were going to talk about, there was one other thing that I was going to talk about, Hillary Clinton's email scandal. So, you know, how many scandals are we thinking that she's going to go through? Before they announce that she's not actually going to be running.
No, she's batting like one every 2 weeks right now.
And I say that, but I don't really mean that. I think she is going to run. I think she fully believes that the Democrat Party is going to back her. I don't think they will, but I think she believes that. I think she thinks it's her turn, and I think she's going to get ugly when they turn on her. I think it's going to get ugly. And that could work to our advantage. I just hope that we don't blow it. Because here's my I'm going to give you some spoilers here. I think Hillary really thinks that she wants that she's going after the nomination. I think she thinks she deserves the nomination. I think she thinks she deserved it the last time, and that Obama took it unfairly from her. And we've seen what she does when she's challenged. I mean, we've been talking about that there's been stuff come up, here and there about the whole birther nonsense. What was President Obama born in the United States? I don't care where he was born. I don't think he's competent as president, and I think his lack of qualifications to be the president of the United States have very little to do with where he was born. But I think that, that the whole birther thing was started by a lawyer for the Clinton campaign, right?
Right.
You knew that, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's
what she did when she felt that her birthright was being threatened in the 2008 primary. She started spreading stuff about whether or not Obama was born in the United States. What do you think she's going to do when they challenge her this time? Especially when the challenger looks to be Elizabeth Warren, and we've already proven that not only was she not Cherokee, but and she went to work at Harvard as the first woman of color based on her Cherokee heritage, which doesn't actually exist. So what do you think Hillary would do with that? I mean, you've already got the ammunition, and I'm sure that there's more that we don't know about. Keep in mind, not only did Elizabeth Warren not have Cherokee heritage, her family helped put the Cherokee Nation on the Trail of Tears during the Jackson administration. So that's actually on record, that this is her family that participated in the rounding up of the Cherokee people. Okay. What do you think Hillary's going to do with that? And what's the Democrat Party going to do to Hillary? So between the two of them, they could do a pretty good job of taking each other down for us.
You're missing one point here.
The question is, who do we put forward? How do we make sure that they don't take themselves out of the running? How do we get them to stop talking?
You're only missing one thing here, though. You're making an assumption here that the on the liberal side, someone could be too left, too liberal, too wrong, too whatever for them.
I don't know that necessarily pans out. And here's the thing. I'm not saying that they won't still hold together and vote for one or the other. But I think that a battle that could get as vicious as it really could might turn off a few moderates. And that's what we need. We need them to piss off the moderates. We need moderates who say, man, it doesn't matter who they put forth, they're both awful. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, we're not going to get the hard left. Nobody expects us to. I mean, the hard left is going to vote for the D no matter what. If they, we have two things that could save us. One, they piss off enough moderates that they don't want to vote Democrat. That's one. And two, they make everybody so tired of listening to it that a few of the hardcore lefties stay home. I mean, look at, they need somebody, we need them to not excite the base. We need them to irritate the base. And if you look at what happened, I mean, that's what happened to Republicans in 2012. Everybody knows that if we had a President Romney right now, we'd be in a very different position. We would not be bowing to foreign leaders. We might not be in the ideal position. If you're conservative, you might not like everything that a president, I'm not saying that I would like everything that he did, but I don't think that we would be considering going around the Senate to make a deal with Iran at the cost of our relationship with Israel. I don't think we would be kowtowing to Putin and you know, showing off the flexibility that we now have. I don't think that that would be happening if Romney were president right now. And I don't think there are very many people who do, which is why if you put out a poll right now, Romney beats Obama in a landslide because people are tired of it. But if you notice, nobody could get excited about him when he was running because they went ahead and picked somebody who was going to irritate enough of the conservative base that 3 million registered Republicans stayed home. Mm-hmm. If we can get the Democrats to do that in those numbers, we have a pretty good shot. You see what I'm saying? If we get Hillary and Elizabeth Warren to just irritate enough people into staying home, they kind of make our case for us. If that makes any sense, we don't necessarily need to win votes from the hard left. We just need to convince them it's not worth their time to go vote for the guy that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got just about a minute left. Tammy, what have we got going on this week? We got the red wine on Wednesday, or is that next week? Are we doing
every other
week?
Nope, absolutely. We've got the red wine coming up this Wednesday. And they've got they got a really good show planned. Friday,
cool.
We've got Getting Hammered with myself and Stevie J. West. And we have a special sports show coming up here pretty soon with a couple of special guests as well. Not sure exactly when it's going to be, next week or so.
Oh, okay. And this coming weekend, I'm going to be hanging out with Miss Ruth at Comic-Con in Indianapolis. We're going to be hanging out with Tony Katz and just spending some time in India, and so I'll probably be talking about that a bit when I come back on Monday. You can make fun of the dorkiness
mm-hmm.
later, Stephen.
Mm-hmm. What? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, you know you're going to pick on me. But, you know, we have some fun, and actually we ran into, if you check my Twitter feed, even from today, at VA Cruda, I've got pictures of Misfit Baby and her. She got to meet Kevin Sorbo at CPAC, so that was kind of fun.
And me,
we stopped him. We're like, "Do you have? Wait, you too. We met you too." We asked him if he had time for a picture, and he turned around because he was on his way to do something. He turns around and he saw Misfit Baby, and he said, "You cheated! You brought a baby!" And then he got in the picture. So it was pretty cool. Nice guy. Go see his movies. And, you know, he posts some pretty good stuff on Twitter. He's at K Sorb if you want to follow him, too. So have a good night, guys. Blackball the daddy-o. Blackball.